wandered down sleep's vast and sunless vale, where silence and Cimmerian darkness lay, that never moon nor stars disturb, nor day with sword of golden light. Beside the trail I, groping, followed through that secret dale, a deep and voiceless river stole its way. Dark Lethe's stream, owning whose opiate sway, I onward went without a doubt or fail. Till, lo, the atramental veil of night, that stifling hung about, behind, before, was sudden parted by some unseen hand, and on my vision leapt a marvelous sight, a green and joyous plain with fair skies o'er, the dream god's sunlight-drenched, enchanted land. This is the beginning. The beginning which indicates a continuity and ultimately an end of the Ask Dr. Hal Show, live on radio. Greetings, dear fiends, and especially if anyone is listening over at Dermophilia, I didn't have time to pay you a pre-show visit, but I certainly hope that you will be there after the show, because I wish to come and work, even under the terrible strictures of the enclosed and closing deadline, which is binding all my days and nights. And it is possible that when I turn this particular job in, it will be rejected, since I may not be able to explain my vision adequately. But at least I will be out from under and able to do a different kind of nonsense than that which has occupied me for the past weeks. In the meantime, the cartooning sessions go on at the tattoo parlor, and I truly hope to join that group later on Saturday morning. Early Saturday morning, late from our perspective here. So the dragon devours its tail, and time is plowed under and yet springs forth. Once again, I am devastated that the general decrepitude of Radio Valencia's setup is depriving me of the opportunity to look at the chatterbox and get instant feedback about whether or not this show is audible or being audited. Without that knowledge, I must perform an intricately plotted show which may not even be being recorded and will be heard by no one, except, of course, gods and demons who lurk outside our sphere of comfortable ignorance. Tonight, I thought it might be good to begin a project of reading all of the voices of that famed traveler, Sinbad the Sailor, from The Thousand Nights and a Night, without presenting any of the scholarly arguments pro and con. The text is there, and since there is much interest in these maritime journeys, the 7th in particular, this will help to present, alternatively, the story that we have in this remarkable document that some call here in the West the Arabian Nights. We will be concerned with Sinbad the Sailor, not a prince of Baghdad, but ultimately a wealthy person there, not the captain of a ship, at least initially, but a passenger on numerous ships, some of which, most of which, came to bad ends. Sinbad was a merchant at that time, and the ships were instruments by which he hoped to gain wealth. And wealth he did gain after a series of wearying and dazzling voyages, which compete with Gulliver's and Sir John de Mandeville, but few others. Now, why would anybody be interested in that? I don't know why anybody would not be interested. Isn't the presence of story and narrative what everyone seeks? People can't absorb information without a fictional setting surrounding it. And so, that is our purpose tonight. As always, I will be closing up somewhat prematurely, before 1 a.m., so I can put all my radio stuff away and walk a block away to the all-night drawing session at Dermophilia. If you want to find people who are good, precise cartoonists, look in a tattoo parlor, because they are not allowed to make a mistake or be imprecise on the skin of those who are giving up their bodies to support their illustrations. Last Saturday, was it last Saturday? Whenever it was, Robert Crumb was in town, and there was a performance by the Cheap Suit Serenaders with Bob Armstrong. I saw the cartoonist Jay Kinney and other cartoonists when they had what they called an elderly cartoonist's art show. It's up. It's for free. And it's in a furniture store that sells large overstuffed chairs and pillows, but it's on the second floor, and there you can see original art by Armstrong, creator of Mickey Rat, some of his original paintings. And Crumb's work, including some of the first work by him that I ever saw in my life when I was in New York in 1964. What's always remarkable about this great artist and cartoonist's material is he simply sits down and draws it without much planning or figuring, and it is usually drawn at the size that it is reproduced. All the rest of us in the comic book and cartoon drawing world know the truism that you must make your work larger than it's going to be published, so that when it's shrunk, it looks more precise and concise. But with great confidence and the skill from having drawn comic books with his brother Charles, possibly even with his brother Maxon, Crumb is a modern Bruegel and one of the best artists of this time. And when he comes to this country, it's always worthwhile to try to see him. Let me tell you once more about the gallery. It's on 18th Street, something like, It's 30-something. I don't know the address, but what I do know is it's right across from Whiz Burgers. Ah, the delicious food at Whiz Burgers. That hamburger stand has been there for many decades, and people always drive by and say, I guess that place is closed. And from 15 feet away, you would also think it's closed. But when you get right up there, it's not only open, but they have every kind of hamburger, teriyaki, chicken, fish sandwiches, and so forth, and the fresh banana milkshake, their specialty. Incredibly delicious. So, go for the milkshake, stay for the art show. It's up until June. The lovely, luscious month of June. Etherettes and Rocket Rookies. If you are at all interested in underground cartoons and comics, which seem to be making some sort of strange resurgence and revival, then seeing this show would be a breathtaking and enlightening experience. Probably there will be no elderly cartoonists there at this time. Nor will there be musicians playing the musical saw, as Bobo Armstrong does, fiddle, banjo, all of the instruments. There will be no dynamic girl singer singing with the band. There will simply be the gallery. And oh, what fun it is to wander in. Not just the comic book work, but also paintings. And Armstrong's paintings are of unusual shape and dimension, and he has built special frames to contain them, which he has also painted. They are works of art. And not only frames, he's hung ukuleles on the wall that he's decorated, so that one of them, the sound aperture looks like an open mouth, and when you look in, you can see a tongue and a teeth painted inside. Others are more elaborately decorated than that. Do go and see this show. And on tonight's program, the Ask Dr. Hal show, live on radio, will present the first of a series of readings, because I intend to do every voyage, of the seven voyages of Sinbad the Sailor. Some might find the first voyage to be the most frightening, as it deals with certain phenomena which I have elucidated on earlier iterations of this show. Another thing I must convey is sad. Sad in the extreme. But my love of truth compels me to tell you now that there will be no Relodio tomorrow. K-Rob will be at a show. I will be at home frantically working on my project. Puzzling evidence isn't coming. There is no rerun that could be put in place. That level of technology is not there yet. And Sarah Z may just be there spinning records. We will see. And, of course, the entire thing will get back in the saddle a week from tomorrow. Because eternal renewal is indicated by repetitive shows like this one and others that are in chronological time slots. A similar slot exists for the third Sunday of every month at 6 p.m. Pacific Time, the show where you can actually see me and my crew as I answer questions from the audience and see monster movie moments we have selected, which I narrate, and see fantastic cartoons that you never heard of, which I have chosen, and all the bells and whistles seen and explained. Our show is, some consider it, the slickest show on Twitch. I don't know what sort of a distinction that is, but we have animation, we have special effects, we have music, we usually have a musical guest, or two or three or ten. Give the show a chance. It starts at 6 p.m. All you need to do is use the special URL. You see, if you think you can get there by writing Ask Dr. Hal Show in the search engine window, well, you might. But you might be taken to a place that celebrates defunct shows that I am no longer doing and be utterly confused by it. These so-called legacy sites cannot be taken down or reached by me, and I've done everything I could to try to get the powers that be to remove them, although I myself find them entertaining. They're from years ago where I wrote elaborate descriptions of the live show, including poems in an Herb Cain-like column, but now that is all over. To get to the current show that I am now doing on Zoom via Twitch on Sunday, the third Sunday of every month, go to www.com//, and here's the important part, askdrhalshow.com. That's the only dot you need to put in there. There's no period after the abbreviation DR for doctor. askdrhalshow.com. And you will be whisked to the website of the Ask Dr. Hal Show, the home edition, where you can download previous shows. And if we've been flagged by copyright and other nosy, noodlesome busybodies, it's still possible to move farther up and farther in to archive.org, where the entire shows rest in a luxurious nest and can be downloaded, it's true, by you. Why is it so difficult? Some people have actually told me, oh, I can't jump through hoops to see your show. It used to be only two clicks would bring you there. We fixed it so one click will bring you there. And that's not the only place it'll bring you. After the show, being guided by the website, you can join us in the after-show chat room. Talk to me and other people who are on the show and a whole bunch of sub-geniuses, and you can get some inkling of what sets this whole Megillah in magnum motion, the Church of the Subgenius, and the cult of J.R. Bob Dobbs, the world's most slackful man. Slack, slack is the soft voice, slack the luminous cloud. We in ourselves rejoice, and thence comes all the charms or ear or sight, all melodies the echo of that voice, all colors a suffusion from that light. We'll also be showing more excerpts from that marvelous fantasy monster movie from France, The Extraordinary Adventures of Adèle Blanc-Sec. On our last show, we showed how she tamed a pterodactyl and, having become friends with it, rode it through the night over the sleeping city of Paris. The beautiful woman and the pterodactyl reflected in the water of the Seine. Yes, I say pterodactyl, but not incorrectly, because the variety that she rides is a sort of enlarged form of pterodactylus. You know, the Mesozoic flying reptiles are in two clades, roughly speaking. One, the pterodactyloidea, comprising such creatures as Ramphorhynchus, Dimetrodon, and whatever the mount is that the beautiful lady sits on. And the other, the giants of the sky. Not only the huge Pteranodon, at one time thought this is as large as a flying creature can possibly get, until things twice and three times that size that fly were discovered and are being discovered. Particularly the giant Transylvanian pterosaur, Hatzigopteryx thambema, of whom I have spoken before. These are flying animals as large as airplanes. Not as large as the biggest airplanes, but how big do you want them to be? Furthermore, they may have preyed on the young of the dinosauria themselves. This was long ago in the Jurassic and the deep early Cretaceous in Europe, where the Balkans now are, the strange and mysterious land of Transylvania, the land across the forest, the Carpathian Mountains, and the home of Vlad Dracula. But why do we have to worry about vampires when there are gorgeous babes riding pterodactyls flying around? And in the clip we're going to show, we will introduce more of the mysteries and miracles of Adele Blanc's set, perhaps even the nude scene, but definitely we will show the dead coming to life and ancient Egyptian mummies coming out of their sarcophaguses and then putting on street clothes and strolling through the streets of Paris, but causing consternation. Ah, what a charming film it is. And the young cartoonists I work with knew all about it. It was totally strange to me, but they are familiar with the comic book series. The European comic book series featuring this character, from which the movie was made. It was made in French, in France, and American distributors thought, what is this weird shit? Nobody's going to watch this. And they didn't even import it in a dubbed version into the U.S. It's more than 10 years old. But we are going to show excerpts, and I, Dr. Howland Owl, will narrate them in my inimitable fashion, just as in the past I have narrated specially cultivated scenes from monstrous classics. Part of my job description on the Ask Dr. Howl Show, the home edition. I don't have a calendar in front of me. I think it's the 17th or something, maybe the 18th. Look for the third Sunday in May, and you may get to see our entirely free show. And you may pay, and then it won't be free, but then you will be able to be a participant in asking a question of me, which I will answer then and there with my usual flowery adumbrations. And if the emolument, the premium you pledge in order to get this to happen, is sufficiently impressive to me, Dr. Howland Owl, I, the aforesaid name, will provide you with an on-the-spot recipe. Just like we used to do in the late lamented nightclub act, which supposedly cannot be put on again because of the cancellation of Ring Monster Chicken John by the indignant left. And and probably because there is indignation left, which could harm any live performance. As Chicken said, we'd be doing the show and then some person would stand up and point at us and say, "Why are you doing a show with a racist?" And then stage a big walkout. Yes, one cannot even make jokes that might offend people who usually say they're not offended, but the Solons of so-called political correctness are, and will not let anything get past. Censorship on the left, censorship on the right. Whatever happened to the ability to stand up and speak freely? I hope it has not evaporated from the precincts of this program. And while I'm sitting here, it never will. Oh, pardon me. Yes, I'm celebrating. Beltane just occurred, if you know what that is. I continue to study the paranormal sciences. I mean, not the fake, but the real stuff. And while I was in New Orleans, I managed to meet and speak with one of the greatest living practitioners of voodoo, as many call it, including her, although others say voodoo. It is that imported African magic. It's Lilith Dorsey, and I'm reading her latest book. She's written many, which contains many interesting formulas and recipes, as well as praxis for how to propitiate these enormously powerful spiritual forces. So we wrap up our musical retrospective of that unfortunate creature, the Wolfman, Lawrence Talbot. The problem with Larry is he always thought he was one of us, but he was always one of them, the monsters. Thank you. Defense and in attack. But then he leaned against a building and pushed his way right through the building, crushing and destroying it. And people on the other side were squashed under a hail of falling bricks.
Such things
that was last
week.
Have to be when comes the monster from the sea. In this case, the Redosaurus, the beast from 20,000 fathoms.
The beast.
Well, what kind of a dinosaur is it, Dr. Hal?
The beast
it's
from 20,000 fathoms.
It's not a dinosaur at all, Timmy.
No, it's not.
You see, it violates all the rules for being a dinosaur.
It's a giant Microcephalian. We've been through all that.
What type of creature it actually is.
Let's get in the mood.
The most...
To go back through time... And join Sinbad the Sailor on his incredible and justly famous voyages.
You know about the ancient Rhynchocephalia, the three-eyed reptiles.
Yes, there's one alive today, not a Redosaurus, that is, a Tuatara, which is also called Sphenodon, the only genus of Rhynchocephalia existing.
Well, that just looks like a little old lizard.
Yes, but it isn't a lizard. It's an ancient life form that has somehow managed to survive to the present day. And good luck to it, we say.
Thank you.
it would certainly be wonderful to be able to see if anyone's hearing this, to look at the chatterbox. Well, I don't have time to write emails to Radio Valencia. I suppose I'll write more, complaining as I do. But surely being a dues-paying member enables me to make these complaints. I'm not some bum on the sidelines. Well, actually I am, but I do pay my dues. So how is it that this story forms part of the corpus of the Thousand Nights and a Night, the Arabian Nights, translated by Sir Richard Burton and others? Is it an interpolation by French people, as some say? They complain because there are beings in the narrative, the Cyclops, for example, which also appear in the story of the wanderings of Odysseus, the Odyssey of Homer. Aha! Someone took that story and stuck it in this story. Well, what if it's in both stories? After all, as we will see when we come to it, it is not the same Cyclops. He is an anthropophagus, a devourer of men and of Sinbad's sailors. And Sinbad does get the best of him, as Odysseus did against Polyphemus, the son of Neptune, and Kerwin Matthews did on the island of Colossa in the seventh voyage of Sinbad from Columbia Pictures, 1958. Read the travels of Ibn Battuta. He was like Sinbad in reality. He left on his many ocean voyages around the same time Marco Polo was returning to Venice from his travels. Battuta was privileged to see many miraculous things, as you will find, one could in those days. To set the scene in a world in which few care for these things. We can rationalize these stories if we want to. When we read about the furry thighs of the old man of the sea, we can nod to ourselves wisely and realize that we are dealing with a touched-up story about one of the great apes of the East Indies, of Borneo or Sumatra. While on the other hand, the apes who took possession of Sinbad's ship on his third voyage seem much more likely to be members of an African tribe with their yellow eyes and their dark faces, and Emmys, most likely. We can note that Sinbad's adventure with the cannibal giant has an almost exact parallel in the Odyssey, and that even in Irish and Scandinavian folklore, there are stories about whales being mistaken for islands and the giant turtle, Fastatokalon, which I have described during earlier episodes of this show. The funeral rites described in the fourth voyage may be a scrambled mixture of descriptions of two different customs. You can catch echoes of the Indian sati, and possibly also, I fancy, of somebody's account of his premature burial in a Parsi tower of silence. Of course, sati is the wife joining the departed husband in death, and not, as happened to Sinbad, Sinbad joining his deceased wife on the last voyage. And as for the Towers of Silence, they still exist, though are probably non-functional in the great subcontinent of India. You see, they are a place where people can bring their loved ones and just leave their bodies there so the vultures of the air can take them piece by piece up to heaven. But now the vultures are deceased because Monsanto has poisoned them. And that makes the Towers of Silence a rather stinky place to visit. More so than when Sinbad did. Well, despite the disco thumping from next door, let us now begin what I intend to be the entire relation of all seven voyages of Sinbad the Sailor. Related that there lived in Baghdad during the reign of the Caliphate Harun al-Rashid a poor man called Sindbad the Porter, who earned his living by carrying loads upon his head. One day, as he was sweating and staggering in the great heat under a more than usually heavy burden, he passed the door of a house which seemed to him to belong to some rich merchant, as the ground about it was well swept and refreshed with rose water. The breeze blew soft and cool there, and a bench stood near the door for tired wayfarers. So Sindbad set his load upon the ground and sat down on the bench to breathe the scented air. He heard the concerted playing and singing of lutes and voices skilled in the craft of song, and the mingled jargoning of doves, nightingales, blackbirds, bulbuls, pigeons, and tame partridges praising Allah in sweet modes. He marveled in his soul, and for very pleasure passed his head through the opening of the door and saw a great garden filled with a press of slaves, servants and guests, and furnished as only are furnished the gardens of kings. The smell of admirable meats came to him, mingled with wafts of open wine, so that he could not help sighing and crying, "Glory be to the Creator and Giver of all things, who parts his gifts as it pleases him. Oh my God, if I cry to you, it is not to call your justice and your generosity in question, for the creature may not criticize the master, but simply to witness what I have seen. Glory be to him who makes men high and lowly, for he has a reason, though we may not see it. The master of this house is very happy, living in a delight of odors and meats and more than exquisite wines. He is joyous and calm, and there are others like him, while I am hot and tired and poor and miserable, stirred to his depths by such thoughts." The porter made up these stanzas and sang them at the top of his voice. "I have heard of poor men waking in the shadow of a palace, but the solace of such waking is not for me. I have seen the rich man's burden, heavy gold on gold increasing, but the blessing of that burden is not for me. Though more heavy than those others is the load which makes me weary, what I carry is for another, for others, not for me. Yet when I have heard complaining of the equity of Allah, I thank Allah, such complaining is not for me." When Sindbad the porter had finished singing, he rose and was about to take up his burden again, when the door of the palace opened, and a kind-faced little slave, having an exquisite body, sumptuously dressed, came up to him and took him by the hand, saying, "My master wishes to see you. Follow me." The porter was afraid at this invitation, and vainly tried to find some excuse for not going. At length, he was constrained to leave his load with the doorkeeper and follow the child into the interior of the building. He saw a wonderful house filled with grave and noble people. And when he was led into the great central hall, came upon an honorable company of well-born guests. There were flowers of all kinds, perfumes of every sweetness, great selection of dry conserves, sweetmeats, almond paste, and rare fruits. There were innumerable dishes loaded with roast lambs and other delicate meat, and jars past counting full of wine from a chosen grape. There were fair slaves ranged in due order, bending over lutes, and in the middle among the guests sat a tall and dignified old man with a white beard, a kind and handsome face, and an expression of calm nobility. The porter stood stock still in his amazement, saying to himself, "As Allah lives, this must be the palace of some genie or some very mighty king." He hastened to adopt the attitude demanded by polite breeding, and after wishing peace to all and calling down blessings upon them, stood modestly with lowered head. The old man begged him to approach and sit down by his side. After a courteous speech of welcome, he had food and drink brought, and not until his new guest had eaten, thanked Allah, and washed his hands, did he allow himself to put a question to him. "Be very welcome. Be at your ease. Be happy upon this day. Will you allow me to ask your name and your trade?" "Oh, master," replied the other, "I am called Sindbad the Porter, and I carry heavy loads for light payment." The master of the house smiled, saying, "Oh, porter, your name is the same as mine, for I am called Sindbad the Sailor. I requested you to come to me because I wish you to sing again those delightful stanzas which I heard you utter when you were sitting outside my door." The porter was confused at this and hastened to say, "In the name of Allah, do not blame me too much for my inconsiderate singing, for grief, weariness, and misery may give birth to rudeness, foolishness, and insolence in the best of us." "Do not be at all ashamed to have sung in such a manner," said Sindbad the Sailor to Sindbad the Porter. "Be perfectly at ease here, for you are my brother. I pray you to sing your verses again, for they surprised me by their beauty." The porter sang the song, which you have already heard, and Sindbad the Sailor turned in delight to the singer, saying, "My destiny also makes a strange tale, which I will tell you. When you have heard all my adventures, you will understand what trials and vicissitudes I have had to undergo to reach the felicity of this palace. You will realize that I have had to purchase the wealth which sustains my age with strange and terrible labors, with calamities, misfortunes, and hardships which are scarcely credible. I have accomplished 7 extraordinary voyages, and the narrative of each one is enough to stupefy the listeners with an excess of marvel. And yet all that I tell you had been written for me by destiny, for all things so written must inevitably come to pass."
must know, my noble guests, and you, O honorable porter, who bear the same name as myself, that my father was a great merchant who wisely gave to the poor, and on his death left me a considerable fortune in money, land, and villages. These things came into my disposition when I reached manhood, and straightway I set myself to eat strange meats and drink unusual wines, to frequent the youth of my own age, to wear each day a fortune upon my back in clothes, and to cultivate the art of friendship. For a long time I lived in this way, thinking that nothing could abate my patrimony, until one morning I suddenly recovered my senses on finding that I had practically nothing left. I grew afraid lest I should have placed myself in an eternal cycle of misfortune, having to pass my old age in poverty, and called to mind certain words of our master Suleiman, son of David, on whom be prayer and peace, which my dead father was fond of repeating, "The day of death is better than the day of birth. A living dog is better than a dead lion, and the grave is better than poverty." Therefore, I rose up, and collecting the little which remained to me of furniture and garments, I sold it at auction, together with the small holdings and few acres which I had not spent, and thus gained the sum of 3,000 dirhams. With this sum I determined to travel, for I remembered the words of the poet. "What is success? The deathless daughter of your weariness. It is to dive in deeper, deeper water, and ever deeper, layer on layer of cold green mystery, for an ever rosier, ever whiter, ever grayer pearl of the sea." I ran to the market and bought myself a lading of varied merchandise which I had carried on board a ship just starting from Baghdad with other merchants. Being determined to put to sea, I rejoiced to feel the boat dropping downstream from Baghdad to the port of Bassorah. From Bassorah we sailed, day after day, night after night, over the sea, visiting island after island and land after land, selling or bartering our goods at each. One day, after some weeks of sailing out of sight of land, we saw an island in the sea with such fair greenery that appeared like one of the gardens of Eden. At once the captain made towards this delectable land, and when the anchor had been cast and the ladder lowered, allowed his passengers to disembark. All of us merchants landed, carrying food and cooking utensils with us. Some lit fires and prepared a meal. Others washed their linen, and others again contented themselves with testing and relieving themselves or walking. I was among the last, and without neglecting either food nor drink, found time to wander among the trees and take pleasure in the strange vegetation. We were all occupied in these various ways when the island suddenly shook throughout its length so violently that we were thrown to the ground. While we lay dazed, we saw the captain appear in the bows of his ship and heard him cry in an agonized voice with wild gesturings, "Save yourselves! Come aboard for your lives! That is no island, but a gigantic whale. She has lived in the middle of this sea since time was young, and the trees have grown in the sea sand upon her back. You have troubled her repose by lighting fires upon her. Now she is moving. Come aboard for your lives before she sinks in the water and destroys you all." Hearing these cries of the captain, the merchants left all they had, clothes, cooking pots, and ovens, and scrambled and rushed toward the ship, which was already weighing anchor. Some of them reached her in time, others did not, for the whale, after bounding terrifically two or three times, sank like lead in the water and involved those who were still upon her back beneath monstrous waves.
I was one of these last, but Allah saved me from drowning by guiding a piece of hollow wood towards me, a kind of large trough in which some of the passengers had been washing their linen. First I clung to it, and then managed to get astride it by more than human efforts which danger and the dear love of life made possible for me. When I was well fixed, I began to beat the water with my feet as if they had been skulls, and made some progress, though my frail craft was cantered to right and left by the force of the waves. By this time, the captain was making off with all sails set, leaving those who had not been able to reach the vessel to perish. I towed and rowed as hard as I could with my feet after the disappearing ship, until when at last she dropped below the horizon and night fell, I gave myself up for lost. All that night and the next, I fought against the sea, and at last wind and wave brought me to the coast of a steep island covered with climbing plants, which fell sheer down the face of the cliffs and trailed in the water. With immense labor of feet and hands, I managed to climb up the branches and ropes of these plants until I reached the top of the cliff. Being now certain of my safety, I examined the state of my body and found that not only was it covered with wounds and bruises, but that my feet were swelled and marred by bites of fishes who had filled their bellies with all of me which they could reach. I know where that comes from. Previous to this examination, I had felt no pain, being rendered numb with fatigue and danger. But now I threw myself down on the earth of the island and was soon plunged in a deep swoon. I remained thus, without motion or consciousness, until on the second day I was awakened by the sun beating down upon my face. I tried to rise, but my feet would not bear me, and I fell back upon the ground. I felt in woeful ease, but managed to drag myself, sometimes upon my feet and hand, sometimes walking with my knees, until I came at last to a plain covered with fruit trees and watered by pure streams. There I rested for many days, eating and drinking until my soul grew stronger and the pains of my body easier. At last I was able to move about with the help of a pair of wooden crutches which I had made for myself, and I would spend my time hobbling among the trees, musing, eating fruit, and admiring the handiwork of all-powerful Allah. One day, as I went along the shore, I saw far off something which I took at first for a savage beast or some monster of the sea. Its appearance so interested me that although I was in two minds whether it was safe to do so, I went forward toward it. At last I could see that the animal was a mare of marvelous breed fastened to a stake upon the shore. She was so excellent a mount that I was on the point of going up quite close to her when a sudden cry halted me where I was, and a man sprang, as it were, from the earth and ran towards me, crying, "Who are you? Where do you come from? What led you to venture into this place?" "Good master," I answered, "I am a stranger who was voyaging on a ship and was cast into the sea with certain other passengers. Allah saved me by means of a wooden trough, and I was thrown by the waves upon your shore." The man took my hand, saying, "Follow me." So I followed him, and he led me down into a cave below the earth, which contained a great hall, where he caused me to sit
in a place of honor and gave me food. I ate till I was satisfied. When my spirits were a little calmer, the man asked me for my story, and I told it from beginning to end to his great and unfeigned astonishment. In the name of Allah, my master, I added, do not blame me if I, who have told you the whole truth, now ask you why you dwell in this underground cave, and why that mare is fastened all alone on the seashore. The man answered, there are many of us in this island, posted in different spots to look after the horses of King Mithrajan. Every month at the new moon, we each take a virgin blood mare down to the shore, and after fastening her securely, hide in our caves. We have not long to wait before a seahorse, attracted by the odor of the female, comes up out of the water, and after looking to left and right to see that no one is by, goes up to the mare and covers her. When he has finished, he gets off her back and tries to lead her away with him. When she cannot follow him, he whinnies loudly and strikes her with his head and hoofs. This noise is a signal for us that he has finished covering her. So we rush out and converge toward him, uttering loud cries which drive him back into the sea. The mare becomes pregnant and, in the fullness of time, drops a foal worth all of a king's treasure. This seahorse is due today. As soon as his work is over, I will present you to King Mihrajan and show you our country. Blessed be Allah who caused us to meet, for without me you would have perished of grief in this desert place and never have seen your native land again. I heartily thanked the groom and was still talking to him when suddenly the seahorse came out of the water, threw himself upon the mare, and vigorously covered her. When he had finished, he would have taken her away with him, but she could only rear, neighing all around the circle of her picket. My friend leapt from the cave, and calling his companions, led them toward the seahorse with loud cries and a clashing of swords against shields, so that the frightened beast plunged like a buffalo into the sea and disappeared. The other grooms crowded round me and greeted me amiably, offering me food and drink and a good horse to ride on. I